You're listening to Beyond Bourbon Street, an insider's guide to New Orleans. Beyond Bourbon Street is the podcast where we explore the food, music, culture, places, and people that make New Orleans unique. Whether you are planning a trip, living in New Orleans, or simply wanting a taste of the Crescent City from wherever you are, you've come to the right place. And now, your host, Mark Bologna.
Hey y'all, this is Mark. Welcome to episode 189. Today's episode is all about the beloved New Orleans dessert, Hubick's Pies. The last show was an interview with author Richard Campanella. We discussed his newest book about draining New Orleans. We talked about the history of New Orleans' successes and failures when it comes to draining the city of water, fighting floods, rising tides, and more. If you missed it, go back and give it a listen. I think you'll enjoy it. Before we jump in, let me talk about the people that make this show possible. Support comes from the Historic New Orleans Collection, the city's premier history museum, located at 520 Royal Street in the heart of the French Quarter. Check out their online publication called First Draft. It's a combination blog and online exhibition space at hnoc.org/firstdraft. Through November 5th, 2023, check out their exhibit about women's right to vote. It's titled Yet She Is Advancing. While the 19th Amendment granted American women the right to vote in 1920, Louisiana laws effectively disenfranchised black women. As many white women began going to the polls and increasing their political participation, African American women continued the fight for access to the ballot. This exhibit tells a decades-long story through objects, images, documents, and interactive displays, and through the words of the women who for nearly 100 years persisted in their struggle. As always, the New Orleans Historic Collection is free. It somehow continues to fly under the radar, but you really shouldn't miss it. Go to hnoc.org/visit to plan your trip. Longtime listeners are familiar with Two Chicks walking tours and their small group approach to public walks through the French Quarter and Garden District neighborhoods. For those new to the topic, they limit their group size to half the number of guests of other companies. In New Orleans, the city allows tours of up to 28 people, but they limit their tours to 14. And if they only have one person sign up, they'll take the tour out for one person. They're also experts at curating private tours, including a variety of themes such as literature through the French Quarter and a Marigny Highlights tour option. They've traversed the CBD and the Warehouse District with groups in tow discussing the city's unique development and characteristics. Summer specials on private tours are currently available, and they've organized private tours for as little as a single guest to as many as 200 people. And they can really customize it to anything you can dream up, so please check them out. Find out more at twochickswalkingtours.com. Use code BEYOND and get 15% off. If you own a copy of the Beyond Bourbon Street Travel Guide, and you should, you've seen the work of James Cullen of Accidental Cajun Photography. Whether it's portraits, events, wedding lifestyles, or photojournalism, Accidental Cajun Photography provides quality and value. I use James or worked with James in the book because I believe so much in his work and his ability to capture particularly the expressions of people. James also offers photography instruction and sells his fine art prints at theaccidentalcajun.com. For inquiries, email him at accidentalcajun@gmail.com. And last but not least, I wanted to talk about our newest sponsor, All the Bitter. They make 100% alcohol-free bitters using organic ingredients. Winners of 20 awards from major spirit competitions, they can be used in both alcohol-based and alcohol-free concoctions. I've also tried them in multiple drinks and on vanilla ice cream with the kids. They have four main bitters now, with several experimental varieties on the way. The ones I have are the New Orleans, inspired by Peychaud's, as well as orange, lavender, and aromatic, which is more like Angostura. Place your order at allthebitter.com and use code BBS15 to get 15% off your order, or shop locally in New Orleans at Dreamhouse Lounge. Now, on to today's topic. Mention the words Hubick's Pies to any New Orleanian and you're likely to get a story, as well as their argument of why apple or lemon is best. For the record, it's lemon, but we'll get into that. Today I'm joined by Drew and Kathleen Ramsey, owners of Hubick's Pies. Welcome to the show, you guys. How are you doing?
We're doing well. Thank you. Thank you for coming and discussing our favorite topic.
Yeah, I'm glad to have you. And how are you doing, Kathleen?
Well, thanks. We're glad to be here.
Yeah, thank you guys so much. This is one that I have wanted to do for a long time. There's so much about Hubick's Pies. I guess we should start at the real basics. What is a Hubick's Pie?
A little handheld slice of heaven. A little...
I agree.
An individually wrapped, fold over, handheld fried and glazed fruit-filled pie. We call them New Orleans-style pies. Other people in different parts of the country call them things that range from truck stop pies to turnovers to all kind of different snack items. But it's ubiquitous, but we do think ours is the best.
I agree, having lived in other parts of the country and tried them. How did the name Hubig's Pie come along?
There was a real man named Simon Hubig.
Oh, really?
Kathleen has actually been researching more of the history than I have, but every time we delve into it, we find another little interesting tidbit. He was a real man. He's somewhat of a visionary, somewhat of an entrepreneur, and I, of course, thought that it was going to all be about bakeries and baking equipment and finagling a way to get a contract out of the government. You know, he would set up pie shops in the shadow of army bases, you know, for example. And he had a number of bakeries or facilities across the country by the time 10. He was in 10 different cities, and he obviously couldn't be in 10 places at one time, so he effectively had franchises before that word was even in the American the lexicon. But when we dug into it, we found that he it was basically a money machine, huh, Kathleen? He invented like a
several patents.
Yeah.
For pie making machinery and other things. I think something
a pie carrying basket that
there
let
was
it
a pie carrying basket. And some sort of a safe, I think.
It was a safe on a wagon.
Yeah.
That, drawn by
like a
horse.
Brinks, like a pre Brinks truck.
Really?
Yeah.
It's wild.
Interesting character.
Yeah.
Very interesting character. And, you know, we try to keep one factory going with inventory and forecasting orders and maybe buying commodities or futures if we think the price is going to go up. I could only imagine doing that across 10 cities before fax machines, before reliable phones, certainly before the computer. You know, the stories of him riding the train with his ledger and his clipboard to go to the next city to do an end of the month closing. And anyway, they all became casualties of progress or the Great Depression or unscrupulous partners. Or we in New Orleans are the only ones to survive. My grandfather had come from Texas in the 40s with somewhat of a rare degree. He had an MBA and was allowed to participate in the management of this Hubig's. And as the years progressed, he ended up owning a portion of it. And by the time he passed away, he owned 50% of it with another gentleman. And my father and that gentleman who had no children, that gentleman's nephew and my dad were partners moving forward. And I worked there. And I was third generation, and the other family had a third generation contemporary of mine. But at the time of the fire, we were not in concert on whether or not we were going to go forward or not. I mean, my father and I were very clearly in the corner of we should go forward, obviously. And all I can say politely is that we were not in agreement on that decision. Mm. But fast forward about a decade. And, well, 11 years in one day, if you want to be precise, here we are. And I suppose that's what we might be discussing.
Yeah, I'm certainly going to mention that. We should mention we are recording on July 28th, and it is one day after the anniversary of a fire that severely impacted Hubig's Pies and I would argue impacted the culture of New Orleans for more than a decade. And we'll get to that. You know, as you guys research the history of the equipment, was the place that was in existence before the fire, was that one of the early locations, or was that just a later location?
He set that up in 1921.
Oh, wow.
It was, if I understand correctly the history of that building, at one point in time it was a stable.
Interesting.
And, but it was piecemealed together like a lot of buildings are in New Orleans, and there was definitely a front side and a left side and a right back side. It had kind of been grown. It was the better part of 17,000 square feet, and the stable part itself was probably less than half that.
Okay.
And you could see where we built onto it, but the reason I'm going on about how we built onto it was the vision was to make it a bakery, and it was constructed for such. It had fire brick walls and a metal superstructure that wasn't connected to the walls on purpose. And when it caught on fire, what the people had planned 100 years prior was that it would burn straight up like a Roman candle and collapse in on itself, and the metal superstructure, which expands during heat, didn't push against the walls. My point is, it did exactly mm-hmm. what it was supposed to do. Although terrible and devastating, it went up like a Roman candle, collapsed in on itself. The walls did not go tumbling into a fireman or a neighbor, or nobody got hurt, you know, and there was a lot of, we had nine, we were in the middle of the block, and we had nine neighbors, and some of the neighbors were 18 inches from us, you know, the Marini, it's dense. So close that, you know, when the city mandated these new trash cans, they couldn't get them down the aisle. But, and we did damage a lot of our neighbors' properties, but when I say damage, I mean, we killed somebody's vegetable garden. We killed a lot of their herb gardens. Mm-hmm. We did some smoke damage to their vinyl siding. It was all fixable, and it nobody got hurt, and nobody else burned to the ground. No firemen were in danger, and we sat there and, you know, watched it burn.
Yeah, you know, so I have some questions about the original equipment and all that, but since you've mentioned the fire twice, let's talk about that. So what was the date of the fire?
July 27th.
2012.
Yeah, 2012. I couldn't remember if it was 11 or 12. How did you guys get notice of it? Were you there? Did your phone start going off?
It was very late. We ran practically a 24-hour operation. Starting with production would end, and there would be a cleanup crew, and then very shortly after that, the pie orders would be picked up by a receiving team, the salesman. In any event, the nighttime receiving clerk, one of his jobs was to light the cookers, either in preparation of the next day's production, or they had to be cleaned regularly, mm-hmm. and they needed to be brought up to temperature to be cleaned. And it was just a very happenstance of perfectly timed bad decisions. There had been a little chain that had jumped the sprocket at the end of production the day before, and I mean, when I say a little chain, it was as sophisticated as a bicycle chain. And to work on it, the maintenance guy thought that it would be a good idea to drain it and start the cleaning process early, which he did, and he had it up on cribbing. I mean, it was as if your car was up on a lift.
Right.
You know, with an oil drain pan underneath the oil thing. And the fella who came in late to light it to get it ready for cleaning did that, even in its broken apart state. It was human error. And there's a manual for it, and there was instructions and procedures, and never did it say, don't light it if it's in pieces up in the air. You know, it was just human error.
Yeah.
It was a very foolish mistake.
Yeah. And of course, it engulfed, like you said, it engulfed the building pretty quickly.
Oh, yeah.
It was, you know, a citywide alert.
Well, though, the drivers were able to load all their pies.
So I remember that day. So my family owned Teddy's Grill on Franklin Avenue.
Oh, yeah.
So we were customers. And I can remember occasionally going to the warehouse to pick up pies. But I remember that day from the perspective of a customer. In my day job, I had at the time about 150 employees. And I got word of the fire very early in the morning. And I sent someone with a suitcase to every corner store he could and bought what turned out to be about 150 pies when it was done. And then I paid for them and donated them to our employee association. And they kind of raffled them off, except for a supply of apple and lemon, which went into my freezer that I hoarded for as long as I could. Suffice it to say, it was a complete loss.
Oh.
Right.
I mean,
the building worked as it should. It preserved.
It was a complete loss. I did get some tidbits out of it. I mean, we did our best to salvage some things we could. Really, that was kind of a labor of love. It wasn't even an economic decision to pull a mixer out of the fire, so I didn't have to buy another mixer. I just wanted that mixer, you know, and it probably took us more time and more money to refurbish that mixer than securing a new one. But the process was tedious. But we didn't know what we didn't know. We didn't know if things were complete losses or damaged. A good example of that would be our pie forming machine, which is replaceable. But the cutting head on it was very particular to us. The
distinctive style.
Yeah, putting the dough in on one side and having the folded filled, cut out, crimped out pie on the other end is not a really special process. That's done pizza roll handheld, you know, the mm-hmm. Tostitos, the McDonald's pies. I mean, a lot of people have these turnover pies. But our cutting head made the one that we wanted. And, you know, without getting too deep into the woods, but the filling to dough ratio, the mm-hmm. the surface area to how much icing, you know, ratio, it's a balancing act. It's kind right. of a dance. And we thought we had a winning formula, and we wanted that back. And mm-hmm. it succumbed to the heat, and it warped, and then a wall, interior wall, kind of fell on it and crushed it. And it was... You know, it was a total loss. The machine was a total loss, but that wheel, got mm. the cutting head got damaged. You are not the only person that I have heard of that put pies in their freezer, and we put out a call for help with people like you, and we got a lot of original pies, mm. and we got them to a metallurgist. Matter of fact, this gentleman has a PhD in metallurgy, which... I didn't know existed. I had we got the pies to the PhD in metallurgy, and he reverse engineered the cutting head.
Wow.
Lots of trial and error, lots of CAD designs, lots of 3D wax and molding trials. We became really good friends. He is absolutely invested in this process with us. Matter of fact, I am his son's godfather. We have developed a symbiotic relationship, and I'm very proud to call him a friend, and we are making pies, and they are identical to the previous ones. I want to say this accurately, in every way possible that we could control.
Yeah. So by the time the pies came out, and I don't want to jump ahead to that quite yet, but we had no more pies left in the freezer to compare them, but... As a kid whose family owned a business, I ate hundreds and hundreds of pies before the days where that you put the label with the calories on it, which killed me because then I was old enough to know. But as a kid, I ate a lemon pie for breakfast most mornings, even going back to the old pies that were kind of in the little tin mm-hmm. that you guys made. But to my mind's eye, they're pretty darn close. Right, they're 99% there if they're not exact. Down to the crimping, which is interesting that you spent some time talking about that machine, because that's one of the things, tiny thing, but to a New Orleanian, it makes it distinctive. When you open that pie versus an Entenmann's pie or something like that, you know it's different by the way the frosting cracks on it, by the way the crimping is. Just in your hand, you know the difference.
And the wrapper.
And the wrapper, right? The wrapper's very distinctive.
We spent a fair amount of time making sure that the wrapper was going to be the same. The industry has made what they would call improvements or advances, uh-huh. and, oh, you don't want to do that? We're doing right. this much better nowadays. Like, we really do want that. You know, that
right.
We want what we had.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's basically a wax-based wax paper wrapper. And I would say it's pretty darn accurate. When my wife and I got married, we were such big fans that we had a custom order made, and the pies, instead of saying apple and lemon, had our name and the date. And we still have those wrappers. So we've compared the wrappers. We don't have the pies, but we've compared the wrappers. And they're identical in touch and feel and, you know, the artwork with Simon, which is also interesting. I never knew why he was called Simon the Pie Maker. It makes sense. You mentioned earlier that his name actually was Simon Hubig. One of the things that I think made those pies unique is that up until the fire, you guys were using basically the original equipment, right, in most cases.
Yes.
And so that when you lose that, trying to get back to something authentic. You've now, in many cases, I imagine, had to either go find reclaimed or rebuild stuff from memory and from projects. Right?
Correct. But that, I'm going to try and not be braggadocious. That would be almost insurmountable by someone who came along with nothing but a checkbook and a desire to build a pie factory. I'd like to take credit for how I got it done, but I am standing on the shoulders of the generations
of course.
That came before me. And we had forged a lot of good relationships, and we try to do the right thing with the community, with our suppliers, with our customers, and we do. And that had, you know, that paid us back with interest,
mm-hmm.
finding ourselves in that situation. I bought our pie forming machine from the grandson of the fellow who sold my grandfather his first pie forming machine. So when I said, here's where I'm at, here's where I need to be, and how am I going to get there, it was, they were accommodating and helpful. Mm. They couldn't duplicate the wheel, which we had custom done, you know, 80 years ago, but they were helpful. And we have a pie forming machine that's from that company, which is a rather large company, but it's a privately family held company. Mm-hmm. The mixers we use are Artofex triple action falling arm mixers that do a particular thing a particular way at a particularly slow speed, and they don't overheat the dough, they don't overwork the dough, they don't develop too many glutens. And what's interesting about that is they're not sold in America right now, for quite a while now. I did yank some out of the fire. I was able to get parts for them, which is, you know, that's that's somewhat of a miracle in and of it, just by saying that. Again, I don't want to sound braggadocious, but a regular person looking for parts for those things would be, sure, it'd be an uphill battle. And then, and I also know what to look for at auctions. I mean, I traveled around with the metallurgist friend and some other engineers, and we bought a cooling spiral that was the cousin of the cooling spiral that I lost in the fire. And it was, you know, it was in a very old, what factory was that in? An Aubon Penn factory, bread factory. We got it, took it apart with a video camera and a wrench set, shipped it down.
I don't know that he has any idea how big.
Oh, I mean, it weighs, they charged us for 50,000 pounds of shipping.
You know, how tall is it? And
oh, it's 15 feet tall. It's 20. It's 30 feet in diameter. It's
huge. Massive. It fits, yeah, what, 7,500 pies at a time?
Yes. It took, you know, it took an 18-wheeler to it's like a grown-up erector set for people. But it was the same. And I could go down a rabbit hole with you about the Ashworth brothers, who developed a particular chain and had to spiral it around. And it, you know, you used to have a label that said this is a certified Ashworth thing, and your engineer had to go to their school to learn how to work on it and all that. Ours has that tag on it. They've lost the right to require people to put that on there now, but ours has that on there.
Sure.
Which is a small thing, but it's a thing nonetheless. The mixers, yanked some out of the fire, then went on a rampage to find. We have a redundancy policy. Almost everything important, we have two icing mixers, two dough mixers, two fryers, two, you know, everything. So we got backups and then repair machines that we could cannibalize for the parts to back up. And I found some in big commissary operations, maybe for a prison or a military base, where they used to make their own bread, for example, but they're not. They just call up Cisco and get one truckload with everything the commissary might need on one invoice. So, I mean, I'm talking about from Q-tips and matches all the way to the food, you know, and they're not making their own dough anymore. And so I was able to get a handful of those to refurbish. And we have, a very long story, we have that machine doing what it did for the last 100 years now. So, again, it's not industry standard because they say, oh, you just, you know, throw it all in this and push the button. And like, well, we do it differently.
Right. And I guess, you know, obviously I don't want to give away any trade secrets, but about how many steps go into the making of a pie? Do you have any idea?
Well, of course I
have. I know you do. I know you do exactly. You're very much like my dad with the restaurant.
Well, I mean, we obvious, there's big obvious ones that I'll talk about in general terms. I'm not going to talk to you about the exact remedy that goes into the secret
sauce.
But we have an icing making operation, and that is required to be made and at a certain temperature to ensure a particular viscosity prior to the operation. Then we have to make the dough, which needs to, you know, the amount of time you mix it, the temperature, ask anybody's mother or grandmother, you know, that you use cold water and you use, you know, you slice up the...
Right.
Okay. Temperature and ambient humidity, all that goes into it. There is an absolute science to dough making. Ask any baker. It's all ratios and all that. But there is absolutely an art involved mm-hmm. in it as well. And that can, I mean, I could discuss with you on air for hours, and you still couldn't go into your kitchen and duplicate it. You know, it's dough. So in any event, there's an icing station and a dough station, both of which require staging and setup and forecasting the orders and the time that product is going to be used. You can't inventory any of that.
Right.
We can't go to a shelf mm-hmm. and pull off a bucket of icing that we ordered from, you know, some international, you know, not the way it works. Then we form the pies with the dough on one side of the machine and the fruit filling that we maintained our recipes as much as we could. And we try to buy locally, again, as much as we can. There's obvious exceptions to that. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not doing it right now, but when we come back with pineapple pies, there's no pineapple plantations right. in right. Louisiana, you know. So there's exceptions to that, obviously. But nonetheless, there's icing, there's dough, and there's the fruit filling. And then there's the cooking. We fry ours. And then they are iced, hot, which is not altogether industry. There's not a consensus on that placement of that stage in the industry. And we use a full enrobing waterfall icer. I mean, it's wider than the belt that they go under it. There's a high volume of icing in a trough that it's a waterfall. It's a waterfall of icing with a little secret device under it that gets icing on the bottom. Side of pot. Mm-hmm. Yes, there is. Our pie is well iced.
Yeah.
And then they spend a particular amount of time that I don't want to go into cooling on mm-hmm. our great big cooling spiral. And then we wrap them in the authentic paper that you said resembles wax paper. It's technically glassine. It's a semi-permeable glassine. Mm-hmm. The pie can breathe.
Breathe, right.
I know it's not going to sound good on your microphone, but I brought a
It has a distinct sound to it. And you're right, like newer pies or newer, I guess, packages sound different. But it does have a I think a lot of New Orleanians could hear that sound with their eyes closed and guess what it is. you know, it's very much part of the fabric of the city. And I kind of want to talk about that. So one other thing about the authenticity, the very first thing I did when I opened my first new pie was I flipped it over to look for the grid marks on the back. Mm-hmm. And those grid marks are there. And again, that probably comes from my obsessiveness growing up in a restaurant that was very... My dad has had a system for everything. And like you, the building was a complete loss in Katrina, but he went in and saved a couple things, mostly just because he wanted to have some attachment to before. But little things like that, that was the first thing I did. I flipped it over and looked to see, did it have the same grill marks on it from the bottom of the fryer basket, probably, or whatever you use. And they do. So, you know, that was one sign to me that it was as authentic as you could get it. Let's talk a little bit. I do want at some point to jump back to Katrina because in some ways, well, let's do that now because I think in some ways, I'll let you tell the story of how you were affected, but in some ways, maybe that was a little bit of preparation, not that you could ever be prepared for what you guys experienced in 2012, but how did Katrina affect you guys and affect the operation of Hubig's?
Well, the answer to the second part of your question is it devastated us. I mean, it put us out of business. Put us out of business until the first week of January '06. We were not particularly prepared for a hurricane contingency or a whatever catastrophe contingency. We were as prepared as we could be for knowing where all of our employees lived, knowing how mm-hmm. to get in touch with all of our employees with backup plans. You have to understand that at the time of Katrina, '05, many of our employees were salt of the earth mm-hmm. from the Marigny neighborhood.
Yeah,
walk
probably
or
walked
by.
Work.
Most of them, the vast majority of them, we had 38 employees at the time of the, I'm sorry, we had 38 employees at the time of the fire, I misspoke. We had 65 employees at the time of Katrina. Most of them, vast majority of them, did not have email mm-hmm. addresses, or a good many of them did not have cell phones. And if they did have a cell phone, it might be a kind of pay-as-you-go situation, and we could lose touch with them rather quickly after Katrina, but we as a company would not abandon production because a hurricane was brewing in the Gulf. At the time of Katrina, we had a lot more production because we were doing the family pies, the round baked pies,
right,
and the what we called the deep dish pie that you mm-hmm. referenced earlier, the one in the little tin yeah. that was round, same 4 ounce as the handheld turnover, mm-hmm. but a round baked deep dish. Nonetheless, why that's important for this story is we would pare down production, and nobody's job was ever in jeopardy if you are worried or if you have a mama that you need to take care of. You know, do what you need to do. And we would always come in on our regular production day, which it's important to know our production day is the day before the sales day. We work on Sundays so that we have pies on Monday morning.
Fresh pies.
So we did not do a full production day on the day of Katrina, but we had a skeleton crew in, and we did make about 10,000 of the handheld pies. And if memory serves me, we only made apple and lemon, just half apple, half lemon, which again, we just wanted something to go out on the market
right.
with. A few pies is better than no pies. And that actually was a wise gamble. If you tell people get out of harm's way, and if you don't want to be here, leave, come back afterwards, your job isn't in jeopardy, and we're going to make some product to get on the market. And there's stories from my grandfather and my father, and I'll get stopped from old retired first responders in New Orleans often. Say, you know, I was stationed at the Lee Circle YMCA for Hurricane whatever, Camille, Betsy, something, and readiness was not what it is now. And there's a very particular police officer who has told me the story that he was stationed at the Lee Circle YMCA, and he hadn't had anything to eat for 24, 36 hours. And the very first thing he had was a pie because the pie truck was pushing its way through the floodwaters. We weren't even selling them. We just right. pass them out, right. you know. And we did that, again, roughly 10,000 pies. It was devastating. It was much worse than we imagined. And we had all these pies. We're not going to throw them away. You know, it
right.
somewhat of a sin to throw away perfectly good food. And we loaded up vans. We had a fleet of delivery trucks. We let our employees, those of which that had a driver's license or those of which that promised they were, you know, might have a driver's license. I remember standing there with keys to trucks and whatever cash we could gather, and given some of our employees evacuated mm-hmm. in pie trucks with pies in them. And you know, am I ever going to see this truck again?
Right.
Everybody came back that could. We got all the, you know, everything worked out fine. Our employees that ended up in all the four corners, I mean, we had to send bus tickets and cash
sure.
to Red Cross shelters in Houston, mm-hmm. Atlanta, all over. And again, kind of a gamble, a hope that
yeah.
this person, not even banking on a personal relationship with that employee, which we obviously had a good relationship with that employee, but that employee didn't know what they were coming home to. They
sure.
didn't know.
Yeah.
A lot of these people lived in mid-city. A lot of these people lived in places where they were at their landlord's mercy to
right.
whereas fixing this rental up on the priority scale. And their kids' schools. You know, there were no schools. That's actually one of the decisions that we made to come back only with the handheld turnover, you know, our New Orleans style pie, is not because the baked pies cost more and not because the aluminum pan that, you know, the container and wrapper cost went up. There were no families in New Orleans. There was no grocery stores. Families were not eating together as a meal and turning off the TV and, God forbid, maybe saying a prayer before the family meal and having a meal that the parent cooked and a dessert item after. There was no normalcy people weren't buying groceries to do that. We had tons and tons and tons of laborers who were, you know, excavating houses and
right.
stuff. And when we got back with our little handheld pie, that's what people were buying. People were mm-hmm. a snack mm-hmm. item, eating in the back of their trucks, eating, you know, on the
Were you around then?
Yeah,
were you around
yeah.
It was.
Yeah, you just whatever you can hold in your hand, reasonably cleanly.
Yeah, I mean, you walk into a Circle K or a Time Saver, and you hear the stupid microwave like dinging, you know, just repeatedly while you're checking out. People are warming up burritos or whatever. Ding, ding. We did get back into business. We got as many people back as we could. We had a lot of damage at our bakery. Relative to Katrina, the north wall basically moved north and opened it up. Not collapsed it, but cracked it open. And why that is significant, anybody who knows anything about food service, you have to have a sealed building.
Right.
It's not a complicated rule. You can't have a fissure, you know, between your wall and your ceiling, which we did. Not even considering the fact that it might be unstable, you know, and fall on somebody.
Fall on it.
But you can't have an opening.
Yeah.
So that had to get remedied. We obviously had leaks, which you can't have either for a number of reasons, also structural and sanitary.
Yeah. We had no gas.
We had no gas. We certainly, when we did get gas, we absolutely did not have adequate gas. We had the flood water got into the gas line and it's not like we were spewing water out. It would just plug it up with the dips and the doodles and in the low-lying gas runs that our neighborhood had. Again, electricity was, when it would turn on, it might not turn on, but for until it turned off again, you know, and completely random. It's impossible to
I think that's something people don't think about as when they think about Katrina, or probably lots of disasters, right? Like, if you're trying to run a business, it very much, I mean, we sometimes jokingly, sometimes not, talk about New Orleans as a third world city. But it was that way after Katrina, right? If you're trying to function, let alone a household, but a business, sometimes you'd have power, sometimes you wouldn't. But sometimes you'd have gas, sometimes you wouldn't.
Also, there was a big catch-22, this damned if you do, damned if you don't. I don't know if you remember, you would walk around, and they had signs taped up on the bathroom doors and in the bathrooms that say, use this water to flush.
Right.
Don't wash your hands with it.
Right.
Don't brush your teeth with it. You might even not want to flush. I mean, like, there was no guarantees that the water was
clean.
Well, water in my world is a raw material.
Right.
We use water to make the pies.
Right.
And clean and rinse and do all the stuff. And there was no. It was an impossible logistically. We could not get an 18-wheeler of potable water to run a production day. And our insurance company would say, oh, is it coming out of the faucet? Like, well, yes, it's coming out of the faucet. And we can flush with it. But we can't make a pie with it. So we are interrupted. We have a we have a legitimate business interruption claim.
Right.
And they did the I see nothing, I hear nothing, you know, like, well, Do you want me to make pies with a known hazard? That's what they call it in the insurance world, the contaminated water. Like, oh, well, read your policy. You absolutely can't purposely use a known hazard. Well, I know that. We're not going to. But that means we're interrupted. You know,
right.
That means we have all these employees that are on standby. We got to tell 60 people to wait until. Anyway, the first week of January, we finally got all of our ducks in a row. We started to make pies, and not the first time and not the last time, it turns out. The city welcomed us back with open arms, and it was a good re-entry to the market. I remember that we made pies the first week of January. We were very much worried about the capacity of the city and the rebuilding effort at that point in time. On a personal note, we were at the very end of a high-risk pregnancy at that moment. So Kathleen was, we had other concerns also. But the pie sales went in the right direction, obviously. We put a little bit of money in our pocket, and we made the decision to buy a new delivery truck, which might not have been the wisest investment at that point in time. And we lost a handful of delivery trucks in Katrina. I mean, literally upside down. And a lot of our drivers, many of our salesmen lived in St. Bernard Parish.
Mm-hmm.
And once you had been with us for a window of time, you were allowed to take your truck home. You know, you had to take home. I think we lost a half dozen trucks, complete loss. So, and work trucks were hard to come by at that point in time. And again, this is another example of doing the right thing and establishing relationships and buying local. And we called up our dealer and said, well, you know, we need another one. And we'd actually had just taken one right before Katrina. And the conversation was literally, hey, you know that red one that I haven't paid you for yet? It's broke. And you know, I don't know what we're going to do about that. Our insurance company is giving us the runaround, but I need another one, you know. And I will never forget the guy said, what color do you want? Like, yeah. So we got it. We decaled it up as lickety-split as we could. And why that's important is we got it into the first parades.
Yeah, makes sense.
We were not officially in the parades. We just jumped in front
right.
of the parades.
Well, they had asked us to help feed the police, and there was really no other way to get the pies individually wrapped safely without getting crushed without a pie van.
Yeah, so that's good advertising too, right?
It was a delivery truck. I remember I had my true story. I had our maintenance guy weld brackets.
Oh, wait. Are you telling the story to the public?
It's been 15 years, 18 years.
We had a new baby.
We just saw her. Right. She lived, right?
Right, right. I just saw her walk out of the house.
We had a new baby.
A happy ending.
Healthy. Mama and baby were healthy. Our first child. And we welded a bracket that held her little bassinet in the delivery truck.
Between the two front seats.
There was no latch down points.
Every
there
policeman was, looked in the window and was like, huh.
But she made it.
She made it.
We saw her this morning. I kind of want to shift directions a little bit and talk about, I want to talk about the rebuilding after the fire, and as much as you are willing to talk about this, you know, it took a long time. But I want to insert here for a minute. We've danced around. What kinds of pies do you sell, or what kinds of pies did you sell, and what kind of pies do you sell today? Obviously, we've talked about lemon and apple. I'm guessing are the two most popular. I'm hoping lemon is the most popular.
Of course.
Yeah, because otherwise...
It's your favorite, right?
People would have made a mistake there. With all apologies to my wife, who's an apple fan. We've managed to work it out in our household. But what other kinds of pies do you guys make?
Well, we have a core of six that we haven't even brought back
yet. Right.
So we're working on that. And it has to do with price and availability and quality and all that.
You know? Mm-hmm.
And season.
Yep.
And even though you could make... For example, a strawberry pie, probably any time, we like to source our strawberries locally. But nonetheless, the six core would be apple and lemon, obviously, peach, pineapple, chocolate, and coconut. And all of the smaller flavors plus a seasonal flavor. The seasonal flavor might be blueberry, cherry, strawberry, sweet potato, a handful of other. We made a banana pie one time. We experimented with a coffee or a cafe au lait pie that we were trying to come up with one time. But apple and lemon are absolutely the two strongest sellers, and they make up together way more than half of our sales.
Sure. Well,
all the other ones put together make up the remaining. And we right now have reintroduced chocolate to the market. So we only have, that's it, apple, lemon, and chocolate. And
today.
You heard me crinkle a pie earlier, and that's what I have, an apple, a lemon, and a chocolate. We are actively, as in the next production run after this conversation, going to be experimenting with our old coconut and peach flavors, and we're going to see which ones we enjoy the most and which ones we think are... duplicated as authentically as possible. I don't think we're going to introduce peach and coconut at the same time, but they will be, it'll be a 1-2. It'll be one right after the other. Pineapple will be coming right after that, and then we'll probably start to do whatever seasonal stuff we can do. My hope is that, of course, it's, you know, 110 degrees outside right now, but by the time fall gets here and there's a slight break, we will be doing our sweet potato. We made a really good sweet potato.
Yes.
Again, our sweet potato was made with jumbo yams that were harvested out of the fields in the western side of the state. We had a really good relationship with the sweet potato co-op that they have over there. We would call them up and say we need this many. I mean, they would come in the farmer's pickup truck, you know.
Right.
And he, you know, we had a rain, we had mud, we can't get them out of the field. You're going to have to wait a day. And we would not make sweet potato pies because we couldn't get those sweet potatoes. There was never any call up Cisco and get a pallet of number 10 cans of sweet potato filling. Which, by the way, you can get sweet potato filling right now that is 100% tapioca pudding flavored to taste like a sweet potato. You know, we're not doing that. It's not an option. We're not what we're doing. We bought real potatoes, boiled them, peeled them, you know, and made decisions on the ones that might have had a brown spot on them, and just like you would do in your kitchen. We have a recipe that, again, we're pretty proud of, and we made a really good sweet potato pie.
Yep.
And I would like to do it again. And if we can't, we're not going to have sweet potato.
Mm-hmm.
We're not buying the number 10 cans of...
Right. And you guys have been very deliberate about that since you've come back. And, you know, I think there was a lot of celebration when you came back, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But then a lot of people are like, well, what about the other flavors? And I'm a fan of the strawberry one, but I love that it's seasonal and that, you know, sort of about the time of the strawberry festival, you can expect to see, or in the past, you'd expect to see a strawberry pie, and like seasonal things, you'd get it for a little while and then it would go away and, you know, you'd drift back to whatever and then come back around again, sort of like king cake, you know. And
I think on our
respect,
website,
I think it's great.
Kathleen can confirm this, but you can sign up for pie mail, and you can be kept informed when
a new flavor
might be coming. Mm-hmm. And we do let people order pies now,
right?
Which
online for delivery.
Online for delivery, and we kind of, I don't want to say we didn't anticipate. Well, we did anticipate. We couldn't handle the volume, and
in November,
yeah.
And a lot of people had ordered pies, and they were not shipped out immediately. We fulfilled all the orders.
Sure,
absolutely. And we, of course, if anybody said, they were for my spouse's birthday, and they didn't get here on time, we would give them a coupon for another free order, or ask them if they wanted a refund, whatever the case was. We have now figured out with technology that you can forecast your order. You can say, I want it the week before Thanksgiving, or the week before, you know, Christmas, or my kid's birthday is whenever. So we have a way to pre-order pies way into the future, and we
schedule delivery.
Yeah, we build the incidental, the point of sale stuff around that core. Mm-hmm. So, and for example, if we had, and we put a number on it, we capped out what we should be able to get into the FedEx truck daily.
All right.
And if somebody said, I want to add to that order and we don't have the capacity, they have the option to put their order on the next day's order.
So, yeah, makes sense.
So hopefully anybody with a little bit of planning is going to be able to get their kid for the birthday, for the Christmas, whatever, the pies that they want. We have a lot of expatriated New Orleanians going all the way back to Katrina.
Yeah.
And certainly the whole college kid away, homesick, the young man that joined the service who is doing his basic training at Fort whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is a tremendous market.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, a lot of the armed service people that are serving overseas request them, and they just don't travel well. And it breaks your heart to tell the mama of the kid.
They don't have a long shelf life.
Like, you know, he's in Afghanistan, and he wants a pie. Like, I can't get a pie to Afghanistan and have it look like a pie. I mean, I can send him pie soup, but it's he's not going to be happy.
Right.
So we just ask them to give us a call when that young man comes home, and we'll give him the pies.
Right, that's of course. Right.
We've sent a lot of t-shirts to Afghanistan.
Yeah, we've sent a lot of t-shirts to Afghanistan.
The t-shirts. So let's talk a little bit about, so the fire happens in 2012, and it was, you just came back this past fall. We're sitting here talking in the summer of 2023, so you came back in 2022. And I want to talk about the coming back, because that in and of itself was sort of a fun moment, I think, and I'm sure really emotional for you. But it took a long time between 2012 and 2022 to come back. Talk a little bit about why that was and why it was so hard, within what you're comfortable talking about, obviously.
Well, it was a somewhat of an uphill battle every step of the way. We had certainly what we thought was adequate insurance. We had what we thought was an adequate fire suppression system. It turned out that we were not correct. We had what we thought was leadership, management, ownership at the bakery that was singularly focused on making the best pie we could and getting it to our loyal customer base in the city. And that might have not been an accurate statement either. At the time of the fire was caused by a cooker. The cooker was what the insurance world calls a known hazard. And we had to get a fire suppression system spec'd out for it, designed for it, approved by it, and maintained. And we got that. And we had, we were bakers. We didn't design the fire suppression system. That's one of those things where you absolutely have to sub out the work and the liability for it. And we had it designed. And when I say we had it designed, when the past tense, like a while ago. Mm-hmm. And we received the approval from the fire marshal. We had all the OSHA compliance, everything. It got inspected and maintained twice a year, first week of January and the first week of July. And if you know anything about the fire inspection process, you get a green ticket, a yellow ticket, or a red ticket. You know, it's good to go, or this light bulb is burnt out and you have 10 days to fix it, but the system will work. But anyway, or a red ticket, you're dead in the water. We got a green ticket, and we got a green, which was our, we always got green tickets, mm-hmm. and we got a green ticket the first week of July 2012. The fire happened the third week of July 2012. It's kind of like a what the heck, what else were we supposed to do? Nonetheless, the fire happened, it overwhelmed that system. The system did work, you know, it triggered. Mm-hmm. Perhaps it bought a lot of time, perhaps it slowed down the fire. I am absolutely not an engineer, I don't know, but again, I'll go back to the building did what it was supposed to do and nobody got hurt. So mm-hmm. what if, you know, nonetheless, our insurance company, which we had, you know, they knew they were going to pay, but they got into a battle with the people who made the fire suppression system over subrogation issues, which delayed the process. So the insurance company arguing with us and the insurance company arguing with the other fire suppression people, all that caused just silly delays. Mm-hmm. And then when we finally realized that we were in control of our own destiny and we wanted to rebuild, that's when the other half of the equation, that's when my dad and I realized that we were perhaps not in concert mm-hmm. on the decision to go forward. And we didn't have to restart, but there was a significant reevaluation mm-hmm. of how big, how much money, the process to go forward. The business model really hasn't changed, but if I had a great big checkbook and if I had everything that I wanted, I could have built a significantly larger factory. I mean, I could have brought back my fleet of 20-something delivery trucks, and we're just making the pies. Mm-hmm. I am subbing out the what I call DSD, the industry calls it, direct store delivery.
Sure.
Now that wasn't a particularly hard decision, and again, we had decades of relationships where mm-hmm. we could do that, which again, if you just wanted to get in the pie business, I don't know how you would do it. We had the delivery guys, and we would deliver in about a 1 hour, maybe 2 hour radius of the city of New Orleans, where a regular guy could drive in a regular truck in a regular day. And, you know, I-10 corridor, east-west, home of Thibodeau, Baton Rouge, certainly all 22 of the coastal parishes in South Louisiana. In any event, we would do that, and we would sell bulk orders of pies at a discount to brokers who would go further east and west, almost exclusively on the I-10 corridor, all the way to Mobile, Alabama, across the Texas line in some cases. Nonetheless, that fella, our distributor, we had a great relationship with him for years before the fire. After the fire, he said, look, if any of your delivery guys need a job, send them my way, and I'll, you know, their applications will go to the top of the stack, mm-hmm. which I will never forget. You know, so that's the kind of, that's how we operate. And when we decided not to get our own fleet, but just use the distributor exclusively, We have the same people. We have a lot of our existing employees. A lot of our existing employees were our former employees. Mm-hmm. And when we're selling the pies are being sold by, the next pie is being sold by the same person who sold the last pie to the same store, you know,
right.
to Donnie Rouse. But he's just employed by the broker
instead
of by me. But they know what they're doing. They know how to display pies. They know how to rotate stock. They know how to get the out-of-code stuff off the market and replace it with fresh stuff. That is not a complicated thing to say. It's not a complicated business model. But you would be amazed at how many fly-by-night people have this, oh, if it was good yesterday, it'll probably be good tomorrow mentality. Mm-hmm. And that'll kill a business. Uh-huh. You will not be having this conversation 100 years from now with anybody who doesn't understand that. And we've been in business for more than 100 years.
Right.
And it's, again, it's not a complicated business model. But if you can't sell it fresh, you're not going to be able to sell it stale. So why the hell try, you know?
Right.
So you better learn how to forecast your orders. You better learn how to get in the back door and have a good relationship with the store managers and be able to pick up the phone and call the Rouses and say, when the time of the fire, from the time of the fire to now, Donnie Rouse has doubled the number of stores he's had.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm just using him as an example. We have a great relationship with them, obviously, but there are a number of small mom and pops and big stuff that have changed. Obviously, some corner stores have gone out of business, mm-hmm. and obviously, other players have gotten bigger regionally. Mm-hmm. I'm in New Orleans right now. We're in New Orleans.
Yeah.
We don't have any Albertsons in New Orleans. We have seven of them in Baton Rouge.
Right.
You know? So.
Yeah, sure. So it took a long time, obviously. And then you kind of re-entered the New Orleans world with your pies at the Po' Boy Festival last year. Talk a little bit about that, because that was...
our clandestine guerrilla marketing.
Big news in the New Orleans world. That was a big day. So what was it like for you? How did that come about? Tell me about that a little bit.
We knew that we were going to come back. We were going to do a reintroduction into the market.
And there had been rumors for like 2 years that you guys were close. So people were, you know, again, as a customer, kind of skeptically hopeful, I will say.
We quit posting on any and all social media. We quit giving definitive answers to people that we consider friends, mm-hmm. that certainly we would like to maintain a really friendly relationship with reporters such as yourself. You know, we didn't want to misrepresent, but you give a mouse a cookie and, oh, they're coming back next week or whatever. Our marketing budget was at or near $0. I never realized how hard it was going to be to buy 18-wheelers full of flour and sugar and apples and stuff and hire a couple dozen people, many of whom I knew exactly who I wanted to hire, former employees. And, mm-hmm. You know, we're really coming back this time and give your current guy 2 weeks' notice. The idea of that chessboard with all of its fluid moving pieces
and keeping it a secret,
was
it's hard to hide 18-wheelers.
It was
right.
It was one of the more difficult operations to get going. And I'm sure people have dealt with the bureaucracy. We needed a lot of permitting. We needed a lot mm-hmm. of, you know, we needed to get thumbs up for our labels. The label is the label. It's the same label. We didn't make any changes with ingredients, for example, mm-hmm. but there's new labeling requirements. So although it's the same pie and the same
sure.
stuff, we had to say doesn't contain tree nuts.
Like, right.
Well, you know, our lemon pie never contained tree nuts, but we now have to say doesn't contain
tree
nuts.
Well, that is one difference. Now every flavor has to have its own label, whereas in the past it listed differences.
Kind of generic.
It was all one label.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that took a lot of...
But the health and hospitals had to approve us. Of course, the parish had to approve us. Of course, the fire marshal had to give us the thumbs up. We needed to get a lot of green tickets, which wasn't a problem. And if there was a problem, we wanted to know about it. We didn't want to, can't you look the other way? We wanted mm-hmm. to be perfect. But, oh, you know, your inspector is out this week. And, oh, I just got this file dropped on my desk. And it just the time delays, and I don't want anybody to feel sorry for me, but I do want to relate to any couple out there that's ever refinished a powder room in their house. And they probably know that it cost twice as much and took twice as long. And we just multiplied that by the size of a factory.
Yeah.
And we were trying to do it in a secret manner.
Right.
Well, it's a very small operation in the office, especially. There are only, at that time, there were only two of us, maybe two and a half. And so any questions just slowed down the whole day. I mean, if somebody walks in and you need to talk to them, it's all very time consuming.
Right.
So it's hard to get everything done and answer questions or visit with people or just any of that.
Sure. How did you guys conceive of the idea of coming back at Po' Boy Fest?
Well, we had previously taken part in the Po' Boy Fest, right?
Right, yeah.
Long before the fire, and then the first fest after the fire, we sold just merchandise.
Yeah, I remember. I still have the t-shirts.
Oh. So we were trying to consider something that was easily reachable for people and something that if it turns out we couldn't make the pies or we weren't happy with how they turned out, that we could pull out without any issues.
Oh, sure.
So we didn't want to rent booths there and then not show up.
Right.
So it turned out to be a good mix of those things. And our partners with the Hancock Whitney Bank didn't hurt. So we were in their parking lot.
Right. Right
near the grounds. And so we were in conjunction with the festival, but we actually weren't part of it because it would have been a lot of work for them.
Right.
So we spoke with them, but we were actually kind of right outside.
Yeah, Hancock is literally right outside the gates. And so you guys were set up in the parking lot. Also, something that couldn't have happened at the time of the fire so much because social media has changed is that morning, like you guys just got crazy social media as people started to find out that you were there. Again, we're sitting here just a couple miles from that location. I live even closer to it, and people started texting saying, there's Hubig's pies.
Well, we sent out a press release
right.
to all the news outlets that we could, find that
the morning
had any
connection.
Right, right.
We thought we would send it, I think, at 10 a.m., but we ended up getting set up for 9 a.m., so we started calling people and telling people, and we had some signs up. But people did not believe us at first. But we got a lot of weird looks walking past us like, what in the world is going on there? Like, it was a surprise, I think, for most people.
Yeah, it was. I can only imagine the emotions for you guys on that day, and I'll ask you about that. But as a customer and as someone that, again, grew up with the pies, it was really emotional to come and buy a box of pies and to see you guys there and to see the excitement, not only of, say, just everyone, like, excited at 9 in the morning, 9:15 on a Sunday morning, I think, lined up to buy Hubig's pies again, We take our customs and our traditions really seriously in New Orleans. We don't let them go easily. What was that day like for you guys?
Oh, it was very heartwarming. It was a good day, obviously. The location, the logistics came together, which took a little bit of doing. The people were, with no exceptions, just welcomed us with open arms, very encouraging. We had some former employees that were at the shop making pies. Our new big delivery truck did not come in on time, and we had to borrow a truck from the broker. And he's like, absolutely, here are the keys. We called upon friends to man the stations, which was nice that we had that support. We set up tents. One of the reasons why we had to be a little bit outside the footprint of the festival was we were hoping to get the response that we got.
Yeah, it was overwhelming.
And
it would have flooded the festival.
Yeah, I think you get a 10 by 10 booth.
Right.
I mean, we're all happy to do a 10 by 10 booth, maybe in the future. Mm-hmm. But we knew that was going to be hopefully inadequate. And it turned out that it was. Like I mentioned earlier, Sunday is a production day for Monday Pies. I actually overshot. I thought I was bringing more pies than we needed, and we sold out. I mean,
it was quick.
Oh, we sold out immediately. We had to get in the truck and go get more.
So we made pies that Saturday.
Okay. In anticipation.
An unusual, day.
The absolute first pies were made on Saturday for Po' Boy Fest Sunday. Sunday, we had production day for Monday. Like, that broker was lined up to get pies into stores on Monday, and we had to go steal some of the...
Well, we didn't have to, but
we
did.
And then we sold out of those. And we had to fold up tent and go home. I mean, midday.
Yeah, it was quick. It was a couple hours.
Yeah. We encouraged our customers to support that which they cherished, and they did. Mm-hmm. So it was nice. It was very nice. The weather was great.
It was.
The location worked out well. The logistics worked out well, and lots of happy, smiling faces. And one of the reasons that we knew that we were going to need at least twice as much room as a regular Po' Boy Fest tent, for example, was we knew that there was going to be old-timers that came up and said, I have a memory, and I want to share it with you. And mm-hmm. and some of them were, you know, I love the pie, and it's absolutely the same, and this is the first thing I ate after the hurricane or whatever the case is. The other was the people, and we knew that this was going to happen with all of our customer bases across it, that we knew that your backyard used to be bigger, your dad used to be stronger, the fish was this big. When I was a kid, they were like this. You know, they used to be bigger, they used to be smaller, this is different, and it's not. I mean, down to the fraction of an inch, the ratio of everything we could do, but we knew, these are different, these are wrong, and I want to talk to you about it. Like, well, sir, there's a dozen people in line behind you. So we set up another tent,
right?
And my dad actually was drafted into being in the other tent, and my dad and I don't think I sold a pie that day, and I know for a fact my father did not.
No.
We just talked with people who mm-hmm. wanted to talk about pies.
Well, mm-hmm. and you remember my uncle, he worked for you, and we were neighbors of the old factory and all that stuff, so it was neat.
Yeah, I mean, and when I walked up, I saw exactly what you're describing, your dad talking to people, either reminiscing or complaining or both, or right? And then you had the very New Orleans response of the next day when the pies weren't in 1,000 places, why not, right? And then the, you know, people showing pictures of the pies and then them selling out in 5 minutes and all that. I mean, a good problem to have, but I'm sure having grown up in a family business, it's still like you just cringe, Catherine, yep. right? Right. It's like, oh, you want to be there for it.
Of course.
Very typical New Orleans response, I thought. It was a beautiful day. You're right. Couldn't have asked for better weather. The spot worked out perfectly. Opening before the Po' Boy Festival opened, so you're not clogging up on Carrollton Avenue. It's hard to park and all that stuff. But I remember getting a text or an email, maybe from Ian McNulty, actually, and saying, hey, there's actual pies. You need to go get them. And then buying boxes of pies, right?
Ian. I called him the night before to let him know, and he was on a date. And I just kept calling, and I was like, I need to tell you something. And I just wanted to tell you before tomorrow morning. And he calls me back. He's like, I'm on a date. I said, I'm sorry.
Ian would fall into the category of someone that we really enjoy Ian's company. Mm-hmm. Ian is absolutely a friend of Hubig's, I would say. Yeah. I would count him in that category. But we had to, I don't want to say lie, but we had to kind of evade Ian's questions.
Well, he didn't want to get anybody's hopes up if we couldn't deliver.
He's a big source, right, on the food scene. He was just on a couple of the last episodes of the podcast talking about food and talking about rugby, his two passions. Yeah, so I think the day turned out great. Obviously, since then, you've been able to broaden distribution and get back on track more regularly. The pies are pretty widely available now. As you mentioned, people can order online. We'll put some of the links to that into the newsletter in our show notes so mm-hmm. people can sign up.
It's very complicated. Hubig's.com. I mean,
you'd be surprised how many people can't spell Hubig's.
That's true.
My last name's Bologna. You would think it would be easy. It's not. But the pies are back. We're staring at a display of them right now. So I have to ask both of you, although Kathleen's already given it away, what's your favorite flavor of pie? Drew?
Well, we don't have it out right now, but I really like the peach.
Ah.
And I like to warm it up in a convection oven, not a microwave toaster or something. And then I cut it in half. That's all hot and toasty. And I put a scoop of vanilla ice cream between the two hot halves of a peach. Now, I will tell you, that's what I would do if I had to go get one off the shelf. Any pie that comes right out of the cooker is, mm-hmm. knock your socks off. Mm-hmm. I mean, when it's hot and sticky and gooey, come by one day. I'll show you what I'm talking about.
It was my one hesitation when you said, let's not record at the factory because it's noisy. Mm-hmm. I knew growing up in the po' boy business, hot French bread right out of the oven is po' boy bread is unlike anything else. And I knew the same with the pies. That was my only hesitation. I was like, should we put up with the noise? But no.
Well, no, we don't make pies on Fridays.
Oh, that's right. And so, we're sitting here on a Friday. So I think you've given it away, Kathleen, but what's your favorite pie?
Well, it's always been lemon since I was a kid, but I really like this chocolate pie better than I remembered. Like,
really?
Lemon to me is exactly the same, so I was really excited. I love it. But I've found myself eating more chocolate. So.
Interesting. And I am definitely a lemon pie kind of guy. Mm-hmm. Big, again, I might have mentioned it when we started. My wife's an apple. I'm a lemon. We've managed to make that marriage work for years. So that's worked out all right. But definitely. So what's you mentioned, I think, what the future holds is getting back to seasonal pies, expanding back to the original six. I just want to thank both of you for all the hard work that you and so many people did in getting back to this point where we have Hubick's Pies in New Orleans. It's really great.
I'll take your kind words, and I appreciate it, but it was what we had been thinking about doing for about 11 years now.
Right. Yeah. So it's good that you guys are back.
Thank you.
Thank you, Drew and Kathleen, for joining me today. I really appreciate it. Thanks to our sponsors and our listeners. If you've got something out of today's show and you'd like to support me with a tip, I'm at Beyond Bourbon ST at PayPal or Venmo. Pies are available all throughout New Orleans. Again, we'll put a link in the show notes. You can also order online these days for delivery. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to my daughters to close us out.
New episodes are available every other Wednesday. If you're enjoying the podcast, please share it with someone else who loves New Orleans as much as you do. Until next time, laissez le bon temps rouler.